You're listening to SBS News.
SBS is launching a new series on the US election called US Election Unplugged. The first episode explores some of the challenges involved in how we report on the candidates to help voters make up their minds. Debbie Grawk talks with political communications professor Andrea Carson on the issues that the media confronts when covering on politics and elections.
Just wanting to start with understanding the role that the media plays in democracy. There's constant references to, you know, the significant role that the media has. But what is that and how do we define it?
Yeah, so a very important part of a democracy is that people get to vote for their elected representatives. But we usually, as citizens, don't know our elective representatives directly. And so we get to know who they are and what their policies are through the unique role of the media, which provides that information. As citizens, healthy democracies enable mass participation and they enable rational choice with voting for our desired elected representative. And the media plays a role in both helping people to participate and also to have informed choices when it comes to polling day. The role of the media has expanded as digital media has come, has risen. And one of the things that makes this role more complicated is that not everyone's getting the same information all of the time because it has fragmented across the different digital and analog media spheres. And so people are getting their information in some of it's high quality and some of it's low quality, depending what aspects or whereabouts they're getting their information from. And sometimes it gets called out by just repeating the misinformation rather than debunking it or disabusing the listeners or the readers of what it is. A classic example of that we found in a study was with the death tax in the 2019 campaign. We found in that instance more than 50% of mainstream media articles that talked about the death tax didn't actually go to the heart of the problem, that it was not ALP policy, that it was misinformation. And instead the stories focused more on the fact that this narrative had taken hold online and was being spread. So if it does get called out, it needs to call out why it's misinformation and try not to repeat what the false claims are, because there are other studies that show repeating the false claims just reinforces it in people's memories. The other aspect to this is that even the term misinformation can be weaponized. So people have different points of view. Sometimes we might find other people's points of view unsavory, but just because we don't like their point of view doesn't mean it's misinformation. And we saw this example during the Voice to Parliament, where some things were being labelled as misinformation that weren't. It was just a disagreement between the yes and the no supporters.
Let's talk about, I've heard it sometimes referred to as the horse race model of political reporting, like who's in front, who's winning. What does that mean and why is that important to consider?
So a shortcut for reporting on politics is to focus on, I guess, the more exciting aspects, and that is who's winning. That's where the tension is. That's where the new party is. And this is where public opinion polling is used to show who's in front. And often this type of reporting, it focuses on the contest using sporting motifs, whether it be boxing motifs or sailing close to the wind or horse racing. And that's where the name comes from. It can be problematic because it's so superficial. Usually, especially in a country like Australia with compulsory voting, there's not much difference between the two major parties in terms of public opinion polling, and we get a false sense of this contest when really margin of error comes into play and there's not that much difference between them. But more importantly, It means that instead of dealing with substantive policy questions and differences between the parties on their positions on how they are going to govern, it's replaced in terms of time and newspaper columns by very superficial reporting that focuses on this contest and on the personality.
Does the structure of politics these days as well kind of fit into that, I wonder? Because in Australia, and I think in the US as well, it often comes down to a number of key electorates that are known as swing states or battleground electorates, and the campaigning and therefore the media coverage tends to kind of zoom in on that rather than perhaps the wider issues that people are concerned about. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the undercurrents or drivers of news coverage is that it's new. And talking about the nuanced details of public policy can feel boring in comparison. And so it's journalism and reporting is attracted to where there's conflict, tension, where something exciting is happening, and political campaigners and politicians play up to that aspect. It's called media logic, by staging events, doing something new every day, being out in the streets, wearing high vis, shaking hands with voters, kissing babies, those sorts of things, which capture these moments that package it up and make it very easy to be able to report on the day's events. However, it's style over substance, and what's lacking out of that is often the detail about policy content and what politicians will actually do once they get into power. But you're quite right, all the ingredients are there, especially we're very visual in the way we consume media. And that's only been amplified with the rise of short-form video platforms like TikTok. And politicians understand this. They want to get the coverage so that they're front of mind with voters. And so they use these visual elements that they know is very conducive to media reporting.
In terms of, I know that you did some research with Brian McNair on the 2016 Australian federal election, and one of your findings was that the coverage tends to be more negative stories than positive. That kind of is an extra element, I guess, to what you're saying about, you know, this whole tenor of campaigns and campaign coverage.
That's right. Australia follows on from the United States, which there was a very long study that was done that showed overall political reporting tends to focus on the negative rather than the positive. And again, that's because that's where the tension lies. Fear is a very strong motivator for people. It arouses our interest. Probably for lots of biological reasons that we want to know how to avoid harm. So anything that has a negativity or something that might make us feel fearful is going to attract attention. And politicians also understand this, that emotions are very powerful drivers of getting public attention. Now that can go both ways. It can go in the direction of hope, as was seen with Barack Obama with his slogan, "Yes, we can," compared to a fear message, which is build the wall, that Trump used in his first election. And we see those same uses of emotion in Australian political appeals and also in coverage. And it's reflected in the reporting that negativity tends to get more attention.
In terms of Trump, he's a very interesting figure to cover, really, isn't he? Because he's become fairly well known, at least in political circles, for making very outrageous, inflammatory statements. But they're not necessarily covered that way. We don't necessarily hear all about them. And if we do, we just kind of say, oh, well, that's just Trump being Trump. And we kind of dismiss it. But you were just saying about how Trump was kind of feeding on that negativity, you know, build the wall. Now he's remarking quite a bit on immigration, immigrants doing this and that. Nothing he's saying is true, but I guess how do we as journalists approach that? You know, because he's not a typical candidate, if I can call it that way.
Yeah, it's a really difficult question. Newsrooms for a very long time have been driven by deadline pressures and time pressures and seniority and sources. And part of that logic of what makes the news is following around politicians. And when they say something that is considered newsworthy, which is a term that, you know, is a little bit hard to pin down, but usually it's something that is new and evokes these emotional responses in us. And Donald Trump has had years and years and years of practice of understanding what gets attention, because he was in people's living rooms for over 13 years on The Apprentice. He knows how to perform to a camera, and he does that in politics. So he knows the types of sound bites that are going to get attention. And media coverage has been the same as it has been for many, many years. And so it's attracted to those sound bites in order to deliver complex stories in 45 seconds if it's a television story, or in a few hundred words if it's a print story. So it does require a real reappraisal of exactly how news is reported. And that's not something that's going to happen overnight. And in the meantime, you've got populist politicians like Donald Trump that use these mechanisms in order to get maximum amount of exposure and attention.
What about in terms of gender in politics? Is that something that plays into the media political dynamic at all?
Absolutely, it does. We know that women get treated quite badly in politics. You only have to look at the online comments to see that both male and female politicians attract abuse. But for women, it's linked to their gender, not so much for men. This is work that I've done with colleagues at the local government level, where we've seen that online trolling and harassment and abuse has a gender element to it for women politicians. And this is highly problematic because it becomes a disincentive for women wanting to stay in office or putting their hand up to run for office, because they are subjected to this incivility to a greater degree than what men politicians are. Julia Gillard, of course, called this out and made a point in the misogyny speech about how other politicians feed into this. In their criticism of her, there was a strong gendered element to it. But also in the media coverage when she was running for election, column inches dedicated to what sort of clothes she was wearing, how she looked in those clothes. We don't see equivalent type of coverage for men.
The other issue that I wanted to touch on as well is, I guess, the use of, like we've covered already, social media and how some of the news stories and coverage appears in those kind of other networks and spaces. What about in terms of artificial intelligence? That's another element that's starting to really pop up in the media political space, isn't it?
Yeah, artificial intelligence is the next frontier. It's already here, but I think its full impact we haven't seen yet. It can be used for good and bad, like many things. Artificial intelligence can be used to, in fact, it is being used to go through by the digital platforms to identify misinformation, to alert the digital platforms so that they can take down harmful disinformation or turn the algorithm down. But on the other side, it can be used to harass and bully politicians and candidates. We've seen that with deepfakes. And again, there's a gendered element to this. And sometimes that includes deepfakes that have pornographic elements to them, targeting female politicians. But it can also be used, a problem in the United States, which I hope does not spread to Australia, is pink slime. These are local newspaper newsrooms that have been set up that set up by vested interests. They're not actually newspapers, but they look like the newspapers, and they are there specifically to provide propaganda for vested interests, whether it be anti-climate change action or whether it be promoting interests of big hard industry. And they also, a lot of that content's generated by AI to give the public a sense that they're getting local news when in fact they're getting local propaganda.
And I wonder about voters' ability to be able to tell the difference too, because if they've been taught or encouraged to accept the view that mainstream media can't be trusted, that just leaves them open to all sorts of madness, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, this is the great societal challenge about how we deal with this vast information environment that contains high quality and low quality information and how we identify one from the other. And some would go as far to say that we're verging on an epistemic crisis about how do people know what's real from what isn't real. We know the public are worried about this. Surveys from the University of Canberra in conjunction with the Reuters Institute at Oxford find that 70% of Australians are worried about not knowing whether basic facts are real or not real. One of the answers to this is media literacy, to be able to give armor people with tools to be able to tell high quality information from low quality information, such as some mastheads have more high quality than others. There's for-profit companies such as NewsGuard that are doing this online. They will put a rating next to media outlets to try and provide some signals and indicators about what's high quality and what isn't. But a difficulty here is that you have low quality outlets that masquerade as news outlets, as we've just discussed with the pink slime sites. And this is an ever-moving space. So media literacy really needs to begin in primary school, teaching the next generation about signs of quality, and that is around transparency. Is there a byline on it? Is it an established masthead or media outlet? Do they have policies that correct false information if inadvertently an error occurs? Those sorts of things are indicators of quality. But it's not just young people, it's also older people that have taken for granted mainstream media over the years and now might encounter some low quality news sites and not be as skeptical as perhaps they should. So it's a whole of society issue and one that requires some media literacy across the board.